Blog Talk Radio.
Red Bricktown Radio Podcast, keeping you up to date on the ins, outs, and everything happening in Alexandria, Virginia, with your host, Lee Hernley.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of the Red Brick Town Radio Podcast. On tonight's episode of the Red Brick Town Radio Podcast, we are going 2 hours for, as Ed Sullivan would say, a really big show. Tonight, we are live at my home in Carlisle, the Carlisle neighborhood of Alexandria, and we'll be talking about Lena's Wood-Fired Pizza and Tap. I just went over there earlier. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. Then we'll be talking about election 2015 in Alexandria, Virginia, with Republican City Council candidate Bob Wood at 7:20. At 7:40, we'll start talking about Alexandria City Public Schools with School Board Chair Karen Graff. At 8 p.m., we discuss school issues with District A candidate Hal Cardwell. And then also in the 8 o'clock hour, we'll have District B candidates Kelly Carmichael Booz and Margaret Lorber. I recorded their interviews earlier today, as they are participating right now in a District B forum, the last one of the evening, last one of the election season this evening. We can also take your calls at 347-838-8513. If you've got a question for me at any time or a question for one of our guests on the program tonight, that's 347-838-8513. You can also email us at lee@redbricktown.com. That's lee@redbricktown.com. You can go on our Facebook page, facebook.com/redbricktown. Leave us a leave some comments there. Or you can tweet me at redbricktown tonight during the show. And if you got a question, you can leave the questions there. Any audio sounds you hear tonight are courtesy of freesound.org. Freesound.org, our blog, is powered by blogtalkradio.com. We are always looking for advertisers for the podcast and on the website. We have a huge sponsor of the website is the Bright Horizons. They are opening a new child care facility in Carlisle. It's a lot of it is built out. It's supposed to open early in 2016. If you go to our website, redbricktown.com, you can look for the leaderboard at the top. It's you'll see the ad there. Click on it and find out more information about that. They're opening it. One reason they're opening the child care facility in Carlisle is that the One Bright Horizons facility they have here in Alexandria, which is at the PTO complex, has something like a 400-family wait list. But they have promised the Carlisle Community Council that that Carlisle residents and Alexandria residents would take first priority over any PTO people. You can also advertise on our newsletter. We have a daily newsletter that goes out usually between 11 and 12 o'clock. We call it the daily update of news, opinion, and other stuff. That goes out to several hundred people every single day. We have one. They are very active on that newsletter, more active than most news media publication sites. It's very cost-effective way there. We can also do things like send out event notices to our huge newsletter list. Also, you can also advertise here on the podcast. For $50, we would do something like a podcast sponsored by, and then we give you free advertising on the website. That's $50 a month. Or for $25 a month, we can do quick 30-second spots for you. That helps pay for our studio time. And that's $25 a month for a 30-second spot. Trending this week on redbricktown.com was the huge news, and this is probably, I've been trying to figure this out, whether it's the most liked or shared item we've ever had, but onlyinyourstate.com released a list of the 10 drunkest counties in Virginia. And while Alexandria, Virginia has won numerous awards as a top place to live over the recent past, onlyyourstate.com looked at number of bars per 10,000 people as well as local health data on the percentage of excessive drinking per capita to rank Alexandria number 5 on the list of 10 drunkest counties in Virginia. Arlington County ranked 8, Loudoun County ranked 9, and Prince William County ranked 10th. On that list. Also trending was about a sexual assault, which one of our longtime readers wrote in about. Yeah, you can go to our website and search for it to find out more about that. There was some confusion with the Alexandria Police Department. It's all there online. Just go to our website, redbricktown.com. Also, huge trending this week was Lena's Wood-Fired Pizza and Tap, which opened on Monday in Alexandria over on 401 East Braddock Road. Owner Jason Yates and Alexandria Restaurant Partners, David Clapp and David Nicholas, have opened Lena's Wood-Fired Pizza and Tap, located in the Rosemont neighborhood of Alexandria, Virginia, at 401 East Braddock Road. I believe this week they're open at night only. But if you go to our website and Google or search Lena's Wood-Fired Pizza, you'll find our write-up about it there. When their Lena's Wood-Fired Pizza and Tap is fully open, they'll be serving lunch, dinner, and Sunday brunch. As I said earlier, I went over to picked up a pizza and some of their butternut squash gnocchi. Oh, my God, it was so good. It's probably the freshest tasting pizza I've had in quite some time. I encourage you to go. Make sure you call ahead for a table because the place was jumping tonight. I posted it on some photos on Instagram, Instagram.com/redbricktown. Also on Facebook, Facebook.com/redbricktown, and on Twitter at Redbricktown. Some photos earlier tonight of the patio being full and the restaurant being full. Lena's has Italian-born chef Mauro Molina, who has been tapped to run the kitchen at Lena's, and he'll work under the direction of Alexandria Restaurant Partners corporate executive chef Graham Duncan, who I spoke with late last week about it, and we'll have him on here in just a minute. Chef Molino brings 22-plus years of experience in the restaurant and hospitality industry to his new role. He received his degree in Italy in 1989. He's worked around Italy as well as around the D.C. area, including places in Alexandria like T.J. Stone's and Rustico Restaurant and Bar. And he was tapped to be the executive chef of Lena's Wood-Fired Pizza and Tap in August 2015. The menu at Lena's focuses on authentic, ingredient-driven Napolitan 10-inch to 14-inch pizzas made in a specially built 900-degree, 4,800-pound wood-fired pizza oven. We have a great picture of the wood-fired pizza oven. If you go to our Facebook page or to our Flickr website, you can get to our Flickr site through redbricktown.com. It's really fantastic. They use a 00 flour for a lighter crust on the pizza, including buffalo mozzarella, which is they pull fresh every day, and organic San Marzano tomatoes to make the pizza. Other standout dishes on the menu include a great meatball, which is, wow, probably the best meatball I've had ever. I mean, it was terrific. an iron skillet baked ziti with San Marzano tomatoes, prosciutto arugula. then there was this penne dish that we had taste tested, and it was fantastic. I got a great picture tonight of the patio with the heat lamps going and the fire pit going tonight. But I encourage you to go out and try Lena's wood-fired pizza and tap at 401 East Braddock Road, next to the Braddock Road Metro Station. When they're open for lunch, they'll be open 11:30 to 5. Dinner is served Monday to Thursday, 5 to 11. On Friday and Saturday, 5 p.m. to midnight. And Sunday, 4 p.m. to 11. Brunch is scheduled to begin at a later date and will be served on Sundays from 11 to 4. For reservations or additional information, make sure you visit lenaswoodfire.com. That's Lena's, L-E-N-A-S, woodfire.com. And I should mention that Lena's is named after the 8th family matriarch, Lena, and Chef Duncan. Went over a little bit of that and introduced us to Lena's late last week, and here's our conversation. Okay, as you just heard me read the fact sheet, some of the facts about Lena's wood-fired pizza and tap, and some of the menu items that are delicious, and I've spoken to you about the meatball and the fresh pasta that is made here. So as I've mentioned, I'm spending a few minutes now with Graham Duncan, who's the corporate executive chef for Alexandria Restaurant Partners, who's going to tell us a little more about what you can expect here at Lena's.
Well, the concept of Lena's basically came about because of Jason Yates' mother, the matriarch of the Yates family, Lena Yates. Was such a prolific cook and brought the family together and really made it, you know, a good time to, like, spend time together in the evening over a meal. That's the idea behind what we're doing here. Everything's made from scratch, handmade, best possible ingredients that we can source from all over the world. And we just do it right. The food is casual, but it's really, really craveable. And, you know, we're really part of the neighborhood here now. And so it's a great place. It's very family-friendly. We also have 6 taps with, like, a lot of, you know, local microbrews on tap that are going to change regularly. We've got, you know, the heart of our operation is the wood-fired oven from Mara Forney. We pretty much do, you know, most of our meats and all of our veg prep and everything we can out of that oven. It's a 900-degree oven. It's handmade in Beltsville, Maryland. And, you know, we're just having a great time here, and I really think it's going to be a good gathering spot for families, for locals, and just really become part of the community here.
And what can people look for in your pizza? I understand you're mixing the flour to make it more durable, more of a protein mix.
Well, what it is, and I can't give away too much information, but different from like a strict Neapolitan pizza, which is only allowed to use 00 flour imported from Italy, we actually made our own blend. We call our pizza Neapolitan style. And what we've done is we blend 00 blue Caputo pizza flour with a little bit of high gluten flour, a King Arthur flour, Sir Lancelot. And what we do with that is we get a little bit of a puffier crust, we get a little bit more of a chewy bite, we get a little bit of a crispier crust on it, which gives it more personality. And that's our take on Neapolitan style pizza.
And as I said, I've tasted the sample they gave me, the margarita pizza, and it was fantastic. And can you speak a little bit about how all the pasta is all fresh made here at Lena's?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We actually make all of our pasta in-house. We use 100% durum wheat. And we actually have a couple of imported pasta machines. We have a machine for rolling out flat noodles and lasagna noodles. And then we also have a pasta extruder that we imported from Italy. And what we make out of the pasta extruder, we do our own fresh penne, our own spaghetti, we do fusilli, and we'll probably do some more special pastas, you know, as we go down the road. You know, but the most interesting thing is that if you've never had, like, fresh, handmade pasta before, it's an epiphany from the dried blue box that you see on, you know, on some restaurant kitchen shelves. It holds the sauce better. It's got a lot more liveliness and a lot more bite to it. It's a lot more craveable. And the great thing is it's only cooked once. Dry pasta, you have to cook it, cool it down, and then you heat it up to order. This pasta is only cooked once when it's ordered. We make it fresh by hand every day, and you've really just got to come in and try it. And our fresh homemade gnocchi, right now seasonally we're doing a roasted butternut squash and ricotta cheese gnocchi. No potato in it. It's very, very light. It's almost like biting into a cloud. I think you can probably attest to that.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, everything here is handmade. It's the best ingredients we can get. We only use 100% DOP San Marzano tomatoes. We actually pull all of our own fresh mozzarella in-house. It's the cheese. The only cheeses we don't make in-house is we get an imported Gorgonzola and we get imported Parmesan Reggianito, which obviously there's no substitute for. But, again, that fresh hand-pulled mozzarella is a completely different eating experience. It's stringier on the pizza. Keeps its moisture better. It's a little bit salty. It's a little bit sweet. It's a different kind of eating experience. It's like really more Italian eating. And I think, you know, our executive chef that we brought on board, he's a native from Torino, Mauro Molino, and he is really bringing the Italian soul into this restaurant. Especially, I mean, you've never experienced a true Italian kitchen until you've heard an Italian chef cussing in the back. So, and the interesting thing about Mauro is, you know, it's the first time when we first started working together, the first night that we worked all night together and we said goodbye, he actually said to me, "Ciao, chef," and he blew me a kiss, and it didn't feel awkward at all. It made me feel very European.
Outstanding. So now, what hours will Lena's be open for, lunch and dinner? And I understand there's a brunch in the future.
There is. We're actually starting brunch for friends and families this weekend, and we'll go right into brunch every Saturday and Sunday. Lunch starts at 11 o'clock. We close at 11 p.m. at night on weeknights. Brunch will run from 11 o'clock to 4. At 4 o'clock, we start serving our entire dinner menu. We actually have the same pasta, sandwiches, and pizzas all day long. Also, all of our wood-fired pizzas are available all day on brunch days as well.
And are they available for takeout?
Absolutely. They actually travel very well. I've been eating a lot of pizza at home by myself at 2 a.m. while I polish up menus and things at night.
I see. Well, Chef Graham Duggan, thank you for joining us. And there you go, readers. And visit Lena's at 401 West Braddock Road. That was a faux pas. That's actually 401 East Braddock Road. That's right there at Yates Corner in Alexandria. Hey, right now we're going to bring in Bob Wood, who is going to be here for his second appearance here on our podcast. His previous appearance drew one of the largest audiences we've had here on the podcast so far. Bob Wood first moved to Alexandria Seminary Valley in 1964 and graduated in 1968 from T.C. Williams. He's a military veteran, and we're so glad to have Bob Wood. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
So how's the campaign going since we talked to you last time?
Well, it's been good. We've been able to get out broadly across the city, talk to you know, a lot more of the citizens, and you know, completed a round of debates and a variety of other events that have really made it a pleasure, frankly. We've got a lot of energy, a lot of momentum, and looking forward to Election Day on the 3rd.
Hey, well, let's let me ask you a question. You know, pedestrian safety, especially since the terrible incident occurred in the Rosemont Delray area, Commonwealth Avenue and Braddock Road. What are your plans, if you are elected, to make Alexandria more livable? Specifically, how would you implement effective measures and programs to improve infrastructure and traffic flow for pedestrians and bicyclists in the city?
Yeah, well, it's not only there. We had an accident this afternoon at the intersection of Union and Wolf, where a good friend injured she was injured and was her dog. And it was frankly running a stop sign. A citizen came through for whatever reason, ran a stop sign and failed to yield to a pedestrian in the crosswalk. I've seen it at least two times in the last month, similar type of incidents, and of course the horrible tragedy that occurred on Commonwealth. So, you know, obviously first and foremost is enforcement of traffic regulations as it relates to pedestrian rights, and certainly in the in crosswalks and in other areas where they are at risk. I think this, so enforcement would be the first thing to ensure that pedestrians, bicyclists, and others who use the roadways are being protected, frankly, by the laws that are in place. I think the second thing is there is a shortage of sidewalks. You know, I'm down in Old Town at this time at the moment, and I can look around and see a lot of wide brick streets and then also the sidewalks, and it helps pedestrians and traffic be separated in a more logical way. But there's many places in Alexandria where you ask the average citizen on the street in Alexandria where the next accident's going to happen, and they can get you, you know, within 100 feet because they understand that whether it's on Duke Street, up on the west end of Duke Street where the sidewalks run out or the traffic is squeezed up against people who are just simply trying to get out and walk their dog, their children, or get from point A to point B. I think a citizen-based assessment of where the traffic problems exist as opposed to some other aspect of the study is probably a useful step. So I would think a citizen-based review of where we need to spend our energy and time in terms of resolving these sorts of conflicts between pedestrians, bicyclists, and cars. The final thing I think is making sure that we're not constraining the various types of modes of transportation to a space that, frankly, isn't either physically or practically meant for that. I mean, so it's saying that not every space is perfect, and not every street can be a complete street. That isn't many, but we ought to be logical and rational about choosing those which are, frankly, a problem and take whatever remedies we can take to make sure that we're protecting all modes of transportation. So I think an assessment of that sort of constraints and those sorts of hot spots with good advice from great people who are looking at these problems on a daily basis, and then figure our way through the priorities and planning necessary to make sure that citizens aren't being imperiled by these kind of problems.
And if you are elected on Tuesday, and I will say I'm coming out with my endorsements tomorrow. I know the Alexandria Times did some, and AlexandriaNews.org did some, but I have mine out tomorrow. But if you are elected, what do you see as the top three issues facing the city of Alexandria in the coming 1 to 3 years?
1 to 3 years. Let me just give you what's really right front and center in my mind at the moment, and that's I'll get to the 1 to 3 years part. I'm particularly concerned about the transport, excavation and transport of the contaminated soils from what has now been approved in Robson Terminal North. 5,000 truckloads of soil that we know have contained arsenic and a number of oil-based products that are hazardous. So right off the bat, in the very first instance, I'm very concerned about a plan that would not endorse the trafficking of that debris and soil and contaminants through the city streets here, having already seen what's happened in Robson Terminal South in terms of soil that's been, unfortunately, contaminated the streets. This is serious contaminant. So first and foremost, right off the bat, we've got an environmental concern that I'd like to pay particular attention to. Now, the next 1 to 3 years, I'd like to certainly take a look at environment and how we encourage and, frankly, provide incentives for small, medium businesses to prosper, grow, and support the business space in Alexandria, but also how the ability that we've had, the success we've had in large-scale federal entities like the National Science Foundation, TSA, and Patent and Trade Office, as we've seen it, how we take that type of federal business and empower it with a variety of service entities that are supportive of it, or how we leverage what we gain in terms of our federal presence here to benefit our business. So a better business climate, more leverage of the federal entities we have, and then promotion of growth and development of those businesses. It's simple things. The more businesses I talk to and talk about leaving the city because of inadequate infrastructure for passing of their data and their files, I mean, that's a problem in terms of what we do in terms of supporting the business climate, not only in terms of the regulations and rules and bureaucracy they may have to face going through the normal permitting process, but what they can see as a future that's being developed for their needs, a future that has the telecommunication that they may need, a future that has the networking of a city that's full of professionals, and then the way the city approaches their needs, not as a problem, but as an opportunity for the city and the business itself. The second thing I'd look at would certainly be improving the condition of our schools and the ability of our schools to successfully educate and support a burgeoning student population. It is really a hallmark of I think our city should be the excellence of our schools. And so I certainly am interested in looking at how we would build a plan that's fiscally and feasibly executed. The final point I'd make is I want a very close look at the way we're doing our planning and the way we interface with the citizens related to their needs, their community, and their neighborhoods earlier and better than what I think the process currently accounts for. We have a lot of commissions, a lot of boards, and a lot of meetings. It's a lot of talk, and I'm not sure how much is heard as opposed to how much is said. So restoring that respect, balance, and trust in government based on, I think, a more clear understanding of citizen and neighborhood needs.
Okay, so let's get back to Robinson Terminal North for a minute. And if you saw on our website this week, I did post a reader email, and we get hundreds of emails like this. A lot of them I can't post because we need to keep it clean and no attacks on anybody on our site. But a very nice gentleman, Richard Platt, wrote in about the concerns you stated about Robinson Terminal North, about the Bogle Chemical Company, who operated on the site for almost 51 years and developed things like arsenic trioxide, sodium arsenate, all highly toxic chemicals. Now, I will read to you what the city told me, and then I will ask you to respond with your thoughts on what the city says about Robinson Terminal North. Bill Scraybeck at the city says, the city takes public health and safety very seriously. I asked him about barging the items in versus trucking. He says Robinson Terminal South voluntarily offered to barge soil in and out as part of the negotiations for the Robinson Terminal South site. At Robinson Terminal North, that's where for the negotiations on that site for the approval, that's where it was determined how much barging would occur. He says it's not uncommon in the city of Alexandria to find contaminated soil like you have at Robinson Terminal North, where there were prior industrial uses, like on the waterfront or rail yards. Under the plan that has been agreed to, due to the fact that clean field we barged in, that alone is reducing the amount of overall truck trips by 40%. Then as part of the approval, the developer is required to submit a health and safety plan, which will be signed off by a health and safety engineer, a certified hygienist, as well as city staff. Then there are a host of other strict items that the developer must follow that is required by the city compared to other approvals, such as remediation plans, risk assessment plans. There must be an on-site safety manager at all times. Continuous monitoring of air quality, all which must be accomplished prior to final site plans being issued. I did also ask him about the route of exposure, and it was deemed by the city that with securely covered trucks that handling the soil once was better for the environment rather than handling the soil multiple times via barge. So what are your thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, first of all, I would completely dispute the idea that the city or the developer voluntarily barged from Robson Thermal South. That was a citizen-based effort to point out the practicality and the feasibility of barging Robson Thermal South soil. The city agreed to additional, I think, three more condominiums with the developer that gave him what he thought would be the financial ability to consider that that option as fiscally possible. So I just frankly, having been involved in much of that discussion and involved in the notion of barging in the South, I would tell you that is not the way I understood it happening. In the North, what we have right now is we have proven it is feasible, practical, and even cost-effective for barging soil in which the dockage is already present. And the barging, I'm sorry, the transloading ability is extremely common to use spud barges, what we're using in the South, to do in the North. So we already have an instance and an example of how it could be done in a feasible way in the North. The 40% I heard, as I understand from what was presented in the city council session, was the developer saying that they would have to cut their proffers to the city by 40% in order to account for the financial cost of barging over an alternative route. That could well be the case. The economics are clear, and developers have to make their margin, and I understand that. The city should have, in the first instance, indicated that barging should be considered as a feasible alternative. And instead of, after the fact, being forced to make a developer indicate he had to lose money in order to do what was being described, we should have seen the city put in place a course of action, fully costed for citizen understanding, to use that option in the North as we did in the South. So there's no doubt that what they are presenting, they believe, is accurate as they can present it, and I would be more than willing and happy to examine that carefully. But we're doing it after the fact. After the example's been set, the feasibility's been proven, and we already see an instance in the South that could be applied in the North. The last case, this idea of covered dirt, I could produce photographs of the amount of dirt that's being spewed from trucks leaving Robson Thermal South on the public streets, to the degree that it takes street sweepers to wash away the dirt that's coming from the same type trucks and the same type covered trucks. So I find it something that needs more examination and something that I would have to understand more completely before I would agree that that's a sufficient answer, because I've seen things that seem to dispute some of the things they're talking about.
Well, thanks for that, Bob. I just wanted to get that because that's been a very popular topic on our website in the last week or so. Speaking about redevelopment, if you were unfamiliar with an area of Alexandria that was undergoing redevelopment, like, say, Robson Terminal North or some other place in Alexandria, or the area was experiencing a neighborhood-related public safety issue, how would you get to know the area and your constituents in that area?
Well, I don't think it's too difficult, frankly, to answer that. It would be on foot with the people who understand the problem best, and that's both sides, citizens and the city experts. There's nothing that can beat the personal inspection and the conversations with those who have the best insight and understanding. You know, it's a matter of listening carefully, understanding the problem, thinking through the alternatives, and then presenting what I believe is a feasible way forward. And I believe me, if it was an area I didn't understand, or a problem I hadn't seen, or a part of the city that needed more in-depth understanding, I'm more than happy to invest the time in to do that and offer whatever experience and understanding of my other examples that I could bring. But frankly, you know, you can't impose a solution unless you understand the problem. So what I would really recommend is before we take off on doing a variety of things, it's best to understand the problem very well before we posit solutions that have nothing to do with the problem.
And speaking about engaging the community, how would you improve the way residents in the city engage in local governance?
Well, we know that we have a lot of boards and commissions, and I think the city is rightly proud of the citizen engagement and involvement that's created within the structures that we have. I think it would be important to understand what those boards and commissions are accomplishing and make sure that they're properly chartered, properly structured, and that we're paying appropriate attention to the mission we give them. From environment to housing to planning, we want to make sure they're properly chartered and we're paying attention. But the other point is, I think we have to make sure that the metrics of our understanding of performance, what are we getting for what we're investing? What are we providing them in guidance or inadequate guidance that's not allowing them to fulfill our mission? So there's a certain amount of, with the boards and commissions, properly chartered, with proper guidance, and then with the metrics and performance standards we would expect, having been given the missions we get them. Some are doing pretty well, but it'd be worth going through that. So that's one channel that we have. The second channel we have is, I think, the neighborhood associations. The Federation of Associations, Neighborhood Associations, is a useful voice, and we have to pay attention and understand that whole system of citizens as they're voicing and representing the concerns of their neighborhoods. I think another element of this is simply opening communications in a more routine basis at neighborhood level. That has everything to do with personal involvement and listening, but as much it has to do with bringing together ahead of the problem those who have the best insights to that problem. And that has a lot to do with the planning I describe in terms of early involvement of citizen input, an understanding of what their concerns and priorities are, and then attending to those concerns and priorities in a fashion that they feel is accounting, not necessarily in full agreement, but certainly accounting for their concerns. You can't please everybody all the time, but it's frankly, sometimes it's too late once the problem's already been described and developed, and then the citizens are not notified or alerted early enough for them to really make a difference in the solution and outcome. And there's a certain amount of just judgment. How early is early enough, and how much is enough in terms of engagement? We can do better. I just think it's a standard we need to adapt. I think anybody who's spoken for 3 minutes in front of council, I think, need to understand that their problems are understood, that their voice has been heard, and they're answered in a respectful fashion with regard to their concerns.
Well, thank you, Bob. We're just about out of time. Where can people go to learn more about your campaign?
Well, whatforcouncil.com is the website. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. But whatforcouncil.com is the best place to start. I do appreciate the opportunity to talk about things that are concerning to our city and our citizens. And on November 3rd, Tuesday, I'd appreciate their consideration and their vote.
Okay, and any door-knocking events going on this weekend?
Lots and lots and lots. Very happy to be out with a very large number of my supporters talking to citizens and knocking doors. But importantly, just hearing from them what are their concerns. And I'm very encouraged by the response we get and the support we're getting. But there's more to learn, so we're out in force this weekend.
Well, good luck on Tuesday, and thanks for joining us this evening. That's Bob Wood, Republican City Council candidate. Thank you, Bob.
You bet. Bye.
Yes, that was Bob Wood, a Republican City Council candidate, joining us for the second time here on the Red Brick Town Radio podcast. Up next, we've got Alexandria City School Board Chair, Karen Graff. I just love that theme music. I know it just, it's got, it's an upbeat tune, and I just love it. Thanks again to Bob Wood, Republican City Council candidate, discussing some issues, especially about Robinson Terminal North. If you want to find out more about what we discussed, just Google, search Robinson Terminal North on our website, redbricktown.com. Well, right now for the rest of the show, we are going to be talking Alexandria City Public Schools. We've got Karen Graff coming in right now, and then at 8, we've got Hal Cardwell, and then District B candidates, Kylie Carmichael Booz and Margaret Lorber. Welcome, Ms. Graff.
Hello, how are you?
Thanks again for doing this. I'm very appreciative of your time. I know you're really busy.
That's okay. It's my pleasure.
What we like to do with our guests the first time is do like a rapid fire interview to kind of get to know you type of thing.
Okay.
And these are just like short answers to the questions. So beyond school board, what do you do outside of your school board work?
So I'm a mother of three. I've lived for almost 10 years now, over 10 years. And before that, I was in technology as a leader and manager.
And where did you grow up? Did you grow up in Alexandria?
I was born in San Francisco, and I grew up north of San Francisco. It's where I spent most of my life. I did my undergrad in California and then did graduate school in Boston. My father's from Boston and moved out to California. My mother's a native Californian.
And I was gonna say, I've noticed a little bit of a Boston accent when you speak, so I was just curious about that.
I don't know if it's purposeful. My cousins have heavy, heavy Boston accents. Every once in a while, people would say my dad still had a Boston accent, but I'm California born, and so that's essentially my home.
Mm-hmm. And what's your favorite movie?
Jaws.
Oh,
Jaws 1.
I love that movie.
It's the best, and I'm sure I have more sophisticated movies I could drum up, but you know, come on, if you see it on TNT, you're stopping to watch it for a while.
I got two more rapid fires here. What's your favorite music?
I love like classic 60s rock. We listen to vinyl on satellite, my husband and I, so we're sort of into that 60s, 70s an era. So, you know, Eagles and Hendrix, Janis Joplin. So that's like my favorite, but I'll listen to anything fun.
Well, awesome. And lastly, on our rapid fire, what's your top bucket list item?
In the whole world? Like, just as like in life?
Yes, like what's your top bucket list item that you would like to do at some point?
So I would love to live abroad for a while in a country like Italy or Spain, just to like experience the culture as a local and really understand kind of the ancient history aspect of those cultures. I mean, I have a ton of things on my to-do list. I would love to act in a Shakespeare play. I love Shakespeare. I would love to study and advocate for marine biology causes, hence the Jaws thing. As a kid, I became really interested in sharks. And so I have some, like, learning pursuits that I would love to continue, and I don't feel like age is a prohibitor from that. So maybe I'll do it.
Awesome. Well, we've been doing these interviews, as our longtime listeners know, because we want our listeners to be more informed voter. If you hear the answers provided by the candidates for city council or school board for themselves before you decide, and who you should support in November at the polls. So I know you're in District A. I'm kind of new to the whole District A, B, C thing. What entails District A in Alexandria?
So District A basically goes from about Russell Road all the way down to the river, from the edge of Old Town all the way through to Arlandria, where Arlington starts. So it's, you know, from the river up, it's a very diverse district, and there's also new development occurring in this part of the city. So, you know, we're sort of emerging with, you know, probably different shifts in our needs in the next decade. But what I like about the A district is there's everything is present here. We have, you know, some of the old town, you know, there's a lot of high achieving people. We also have, you know, affordable housing in this area. We have Arlandria with a real, you know, immigrant flavor, and Del Rey, which people say is kind of, you know, hippie and earthy. And so I really think that it personifies Alexandria and where we're going, and I just love the diversity of this part of the city.
There we go. Sorry, my studio is running a little slow here. So since you are running unopposed, why are you running for another term on school board?
So I was motivated to run in my first term because of some of the experiences I was having as a parent and a mother within the school system. I have a sort of a business background and a product-based or product development background. So, you know, I really kind of think in terms of efficiencies, and I just wasn't seeing good, like, change management and execution and implementation of programs. So I became motivated to, and I really am a believer in the public school system, so I became very engaged in trying to, you know, affect change. When I got into the office, about 3 or 4 months in, I realized, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be able to accomplish all that I thought. The bureaucracy was quite different than a corporate model, and but I have a certain tenacity, and I sort of enjoy like pressing in and seeing that change and really modeling it so it's successful. And so when I started to realize like there's just a longer timeline to getting where you need to go, I thought, you know, I'm probably going to need another term.
And in this term, what goals? If you are elected, well, you will be elected because you're unopposed. in this term, what goals do you hope to achieve on school board?
So, you know, I do have the benefit of now. I did have the benefit of knowing in May that I would serve another 3 years. So I've had the summer to really think about strategy and discuss these things with the superintendent and some of my colleagues. You know, I've mentioned this at various, I'm still stumping for the school system. So I'm still out there sort of with a quasi-campaign of, you know, we need to pay attention to school board. We run a $200 million budget every year annually. We serve over 14,700 kids, and we have more than 2,600 staff. And so I really do feel that, you know, my goals for the next 3 years are to continue to advance this concept of academic excellence in everything we do. So we know we have some you know, dark dots on the timeline for redistricting, for looking at remodeling the TAG program, remodeling the ELL program. So there's things that I want to see in this 3 years sort of establish more of like a calm in the system so we can really start to excel. And, you know, one of those big solutions that we need to come up with is around, you know, how our school is going to be populated. Not only is redistricting a tool, but we also need to look at how we can advance academics when we're moving kids and staff around the district. And then secondly, I really want to advance communications in ACPS out to the community. This is probably one of the only communities I've ever lived in that doesn't sort of put the school system at the center of what they do and speak positively about it. It's sort of, you know, almost like for sport, it seems like there's been a lot of negative talk for decades around our school system, and there's a history and there's a reason for that. But I really want to move into the future and start to, you know, show Alexandrians, like, there are some really good things happening in our system, and we need to, as a community, engage in those things and advance them.
And listeners, we are listening to the Red Brick Town Radio podcast, and our guest is Karen A. Graff, who's the current Alexandria City School Board Chair. So, Karen, you were talking about the campaign and some goals and issues. So my next question would be, what do you feel are the most pressing issues facing our schools in Alexandria?
Well, probably the, you know, number one issue in our school system is the poverty level. We have to serve a lot of kids that are receiving free and reduced lunch benefits. With that, you know, comes some additional challenges. And so we often talk about what do those students need in order to achieve. You know, one principal said, you know, sometimes our students come just needing basic needs like clothing, food. So a lot of the schools in the system do have extended food programs. Maury and now Lyles Crouch have a program that they're called Blessings in a Backpack, where they, for the school year, send home food items and gift cards with different families that have been identified in, you know, keeping confidentiality, have been identified by social workers. And so there's just a lot of readiness to learn that I think is still we could build on and partner with our rich nonprofit environment in Alexandria City. But, you know, I would say the second thing, and it is actually the number one thing, is that we really need to meet the child where they're at in their educational pursuit and continue to advance that. And that can mean something different for many different students, and that's why it's important to have many different offerings, have all those offerings have equity across the school system, and also strive for excellence in those areas. So an example might be music. You know, in my view, I've seen a lot of elementary schools that have different music programs. And when they get to the middle schools might offer different things in music, or it might be prohibitive to take music if you're taking a language, just simply because of the way we're staffing right now. And so I do want to work some of those things out so that children who maybe aren't traditionally, you know, I love math or I love reading, they're connecting with music. I want to make sure those avenues are available for every type of learner.
You spoke about, you know, getting some of the news about school system out in the community. My question would be then, how can a school board member improve communication between the school system and parents in the community? What can the school system do better?
Well, so there's a few things. I mean, one thing that it took me a while probably to get used to was sort of recognizing that the school board's like the outward-facing body, if you will, like the PR arm of the school system. So when my colleagues and I got into office, we sort of made a deal with each other that we would, you know, assign each member to attend, you know, an advisory committee, PTAs, and different commissions that require school board members to participate across the division and across the city. And if we couldn't make one of those, that we would engage another member to attend. And so right out of the gate, we were sort of investing in this ethic of, like, we need to spread out around this town and tell people what we're doing. The second thing we did is we increased the transparency of our work. So from the clerk's office, I really set up, like, a rigorous program of, you know, we post our meeting information 6 days in advance. We're required by the state to do so in 3, but we have really worked hard to create a rhythm and a transparency so people know where to find our information. So, you know, example is somebody that enters this redistricting conversation might say, my gosh, I'm new to this. When did this just start? And we can say, you know what, we started talking about this in March. Here are the meetings. You can watch the video. You can look at the documents. And we've really kept an archive of what we're doing. The third thing is we've looked at our communications department and really tried to modernize that. You know, and you know this from what you do, but the practice of social media and communicating out to a public, finding that public, creating channels of communication that are predictable to various audiences is super important, and we need to do that in a strong way. And I think we've seen that over the year, that we are actually communicating better and the community is a bit settled because they know what's happening. And, you know, I think lastly, we just need to really incorporate communication into everything we do as a strategy. And so my background's in communications as well, so I really feel strongly about this. I think, you know, like I've said before, I think most of the world's problems can be solved through strong communication practices. So,
okay. Now, we have just a few minutes left. I have one last subject to cover, and that's, of course, redistricting. My first question is just a yes or no, maybe 30 seconds, you can expand on it. In Arlington in 2012, they started community engagement process on redistricting, and 7 months later, they redistricted the school system. Arlington's twice the size of Alexandria. Is 5 months of community engagement too short a time? If no, why not? If yes, why yes?
So, yes and no. But yes, I believe that 5 months is aggressive and probably hard to accomplish just from an administrative standpoint. All the things I described to you about 6 days before, you start to lay that out on a calendar and it gets quite difficult to communicate effectively, to have the meetings in a succession where you're making good decisions and communicating that out to a community. But no, in the fact that we did try to start this, and my colleagues can attest to this, but we tried to start this when we started on the school board 3 years ago, but we really started to work on a timeline about 18 months back from February. And, you know, as it is now, I think that there's been some community feedback in not only the redistricting review committee, but also the community meeting, that it feels aggressive to the community. So I take my cues from the community. I'm the citizen representative, and what I'm hearing citizens say is that they feel they could do a better job with more time. And in that case, I would advocate for that. And so, you know, there are some factors that need to be considered. I do have a strong, and this isn't necessarily a consensus on the school board yet because we haven't had an opportunity to debate together on this, but my opinion is that redistricting is a tool to a larger strategy for academic excellence, and if we can't make a case for advancing our academics through using redistricting, then we should abandon it. You know, redistricting needs to solve a budgeting problem, it needs to solve a capacity problem, but more importantly, it needs to advance academics. And if we can't do that third, we need to kind of step back and figure out what's best for our advancing our learning. So I do believe it probably will be adjusted, and we made that February deadline because we know that implementation, and still it would be aggressive in February if we made the vote, but implementation takes a long time. And so, you know, February is kind of like, if we don't make the decision by February, we need to continue, you know, talking about it and going forward past that date, and then it would probably be implemented the following year. So that may happen. It's all fairly open right now.
Well, you actually answered my second question on redistricting. But I'm running out of time here. I hope you'll come back on the podcast.
Yeah, I would love to. Please invite me back. Yeah, and, you know, again, if there's redistricting is going to be a huge theme, so I know that there's an opportunity to speak more about it in a few months. Please schedule us.
And so where can our listeners and readers go to learn more about your campaign?
My campaign website is graph4schoolboard.com. And there you can find information and my email at my campaign email address. And then, of course, because I know that I will be serving another 3 years, you can always contact me at ACPS at karen.graph.acps.k12.ba.us.
Well, Karen, thank you very much, and good luck in the next 3 years, and I'm sure we'll be talking more as the redistricting process moves forward.
Great. Thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you, Karen.
Good night.
Again, listeners, that was Karen A. Graff,